I mean, if he's got researchers working on Lula's life story, much as I deplore the idea, he might know something, mightn't he?
What kind of thing? Asked Strike.
I don't know. Something about her early life, perhaps, before she came to us?
The waiter arrived to place starters in front of them all. Strike waited until he had gone, and then asked Bristow,
Have you tried to speak to Mr. Bestigui yourself and find out whether he knew anything about Lula that the family didn't?
That's just what's so difficult, said Bristow. When Tony, my uncle, heard what had happened, he contacted Mr. Bestigui to protest about him badgering my mother, and from what I've heard, there was a very heated argument. I don't think Mr. Bestigui would welcome further contact from the family. Of course, the situation's further complicated by the fact that Tansy is using our firm for the divorce. I mean, there's nothing in that. We're one of the top family law firms, and with Ursula being married to Cyprian, naturally she would come to us. But I'm sure it won't have made Mr. Bestigui feel any more kindly towards us.
Though he had kept his gaze on the lawyer all the time that Bristow was talking, Strike's peripheral vision was excellent. Ursula had thrown another tiny smirk in her sister's direction. He wondered what was amusing her. Doubtless her improved mood was not hindered by the fact that she was now on her fourth glass of wine. Strike finished his starter and turned to Tansy, who was pushing her virtually untouched food around her plate.
How long had you and your husband been at number 18 before Lula moved in?
About a year.
Was there anyone in the middle flat when she arrived?
Yeah, said Tansy. There was an American couple there with their little boy for 6 months, but they went back to the States not long after she arrived. After that, the property company couldn't get anyone interested at all. The recession, you know. They cost an arm and a leg, those flats. So it was empty until the record company rented it for D.B. Mack.
Both she and Ursula were distracted by the sight of a woman passing the table in what, to Strike, appeared to be a crocheted coat of lurid design.
"That's a Dormier cross coat," said Ursula, her eyes slightly narrowed over her wine-glass. "There's a waiting list of, like, 6 months."
"It's Pansy Marks Dillon," said Tansy. "Easy to be on the best dress list if your husband's got 50 mil.
Freddy's the cheapest rich man in the world. I had to hide new stuff from him or pretend it was fake. He could be such a bore sometimes."
"You always look wonderful," said Bristow, pink in the face.
"You're sweet," said Tansy Bestigui in a bored voice.
The waiter arrived to clear away their plates.
"What were you saying?" she asked Strike. "Oh, yeah, the flats. D.B. Mack coming. Except he didn't. Freddy was furious he never got there, because he'd put roses in his flat. Freddy is such a cheap bastard."
"How well do you know Derek Wilson?" Strike asked. She blinked.
"Well, he's the security guard. I don't know him, do I? He seemed all right. Freddy always said he was the best of the bunch."
"Really? Why was that?"
She shrugged. "I don't know. You'd have to ask Freddy. And good luck with that," she added, with a little laugh. "Freddy'll talk to you when hell freezes over."
"Tansy," said Bristow, leaning in a little, "why don't you just tell Cormoran what you actually heard that night?"
Strike would have preferred Bristow not to intervene.
"Well," said Tansy, "it was getting on for 2 in the morning and I wanted a drink of water."
Her tone was flat and expressionless. Strike noticed that, even in this small beginning, she had altered the story she had told the police.
"So I went to the bathroom to get one, and as I was heading back across the sitting room towards the bedroom, I heard shouting. She, Lula, was saying, 'It's too late, I've already done it.' And then a man said, 'You're a lying fucking bitch.' And then, he threw her over. I actually saw her fall."
And Tansy made a tiny jerky movement with her hands that Strike understood to indicate flailing. Bristow set down his glass, looking nauseated. Their main courses arrived. Ursula drank more wine. Neither Tansy nor Bristow touched their food. Strike picked up his fork and began to eat,
trying not to look as though he was enjoying his puntarelle with anchovies.
"I screamed," whispered Tansy. "I couldn't stop screaming. I ran out of the flat, past Freddy and downstairs. I just wanted to tell security that there was a man up there, so they could get him." Wilson came dashing out of the room behind the desk. I told him what had happened, and he went straight out onto the street to see her, instead of running upstairs, bloody fool. If only he'd gone upstairs first, he might have caught him. Then Freddy came down after me, and started trying to make me go back to our flat, because I wasn't dressed. Then Wilson came back, and told us she was dead, and told Freddy to call the police. Freddy virtually dragged me back upstairs. I was completely hysterical. And he dialed 999 from our sitting room. And then the police came, and nobody believed a single word I said.
She sipped her wine again, set down the glass, and said quietly,
"If Freddy knew I was talking to you, he'd go ape."
"But you're quite sure, aren't you, Tansy," Bristow interjected, "that you heard a man up there?"
"Yeah, of course I am," said Tansy. "I just said, haven't I? There was definitely someone there."
Bristow's mobile rang. "Excuse me," he muttered. "Allison."
"Yes?" he said, picking up.
Strike could hear the secretary's deep voice without being able to make out the words.
"Excuse me just a moment," Bristow said, looking harried, and he left the table.
A look of malicious amusement appeared on both sisters' smooth, polished faces. They glanced at each other again, then, somewhat to his surprise, Ursula asked Strike,
"Have you met Allison?"
"Briefly."
"Do you know they're together?"
"Yes."
"It's a bit pathetic, actually," said Tansy. "She's with John, but she's actually obsessed with Tony. Have you met Tony?"
"No," said Strike.
"He's one of the senior partners. John's uncle, you know."
"Yes."
"Very attractive. He wouldn't go for Allison in a million years."
"I suppose she settled for John as consolation prize."
The thought of Allison's doomed infatuation seemed to afford the sisters great satisfaction.
"This is all common gossip at the office, is it?" asked Strike.
"Oh, yeah,"
said Ursula with relish.
"Cyprian says she's absolutely embarrassing, like a puppy dog around Tony."
Her antipathy towards Strike seemed to have evaporated. He was not surprised. He had met the phenomenon many times. People liked to talk. There were very few exceptions. The question was how you made them do it. Some, and Ursula was evidently one of them, were amenable to alcohol. Others liked a spotlight, and then there were those who merely needed proximity to another conscious human being. A subsection of humanity would become loquacious only on one favourite subject. It might be their own innocence, or somebody else's guilt. It might be their collection of pre-war biscuit tins, or it might, as in the case of Ursula May, be the hopeless passion of a plain secretary. Ursula was watching Bristow through the window. He was standing on the pavement, talking hard into his mobile as he paced up and down. Her tongue properly loosened now, she said,
"I bet I know what that's about. Conway Oates's executors are making a fuss about how the firm handled his affairs. He was the American financier, you know. Cyprian and Tony are in a real bait about it, making John fly around trying to smooth things over. John always gets the shitty end of the stick."
Her tone was more scathing than sympathetic. Bristow returned to the table, looking flustered.
Sorry. Allison just wanted to give me some messages," he said.
The waiter came to collect their plates. Strike was the only one who had cleared his. When the waiter was out of earshot, Strike said,
"Tansy, the police disregarded your evidence because they didn't think you could have heard what you claimed to have heard."
"Well, they were wrong, weren't they?" she snapped, her good humour gone in a trice. "I did hear it."
"Through a closed window?"
"It was open," she said, meeting none of her companion's eyes. "It was stuffy. I opened one of the windows on the way to get water."
Strike was sure that pressing her on the point would only lead to her refusing to answer any other questions.
"They also allege that you'd taken cocaine."
Tansy made a little noise of impatience, a soft
Look, she said, I had some earlier during dinner, okay, and they found it in the bathroom when they looked around the flat. The fucking boredom of the Duns. Anyone would have done a couple of lines to get through Benji Dunn's bloody anecdotes. But I didn't imagine that voice upstairs. A man was there, and he killed her. He killed her, repeated Tansy, glaring at Strike.
And where do you think he went afterwards?
I don't know, do I? That's what John's paying you to find out. He sneaked out somehow. Maybe he climbed out the back window. Maybe he hid in the lift. Maybe he went out through the car park downstairs. I don't bloody know how he got out. I just know he was there.
We believe you, interjected Bristow anxiously. We believe you, Tansy. Cormoran needs to ask these questions to get a clear picture of how it all happened.
The police did everything they could to discredit me, said Tansy, disregarding Bristow and addressing Strike. They got there too late and he'd already gone, so of course they covered it up. No one who hasn't been through what I went through with the press can understand what it was like. It was absolute bloody hell. I went into the clinic just to get away from it all. I can't believe it's legal, what the press are allowed to do in this country. And all for telling the truth. That's the bloody joke. I should have kept my mouth shut, shouldn't I? I would have if I'd known what was coming.
She twisted her loose diamond ring around her finger.
Freddy was asleep in bed when Lula fell, wasn't he?
Strike asked Tansy.
Yeah, that's right, she said.
Her hand slid up to her face, and she smoothed non-existent strands of hair off her forehead.
The waiter returned with menus again, and Strike was forced to hold back his questions until they had ordered. He was the only one to ask for pudding. All the rest had coffee.
When did Freddy get out of bed?
He asked Tansy, when the waiter had left.
What do you mean?
You say he was in bed when Lula fell. When did he get up?
When he heard me screaming, she said,
as though this was obvious.
I woke him up, didn't I?
He must have moved quickly.
Why?
You said, I ran out of the flat past Freddy and downstairs. So he was already in the room before you ran out to tell Derek what had happened.
A missed beat.
That's right, she said, smoothing her immaculate hair again, shielding her face.
So he went from fast asleep in bed to awake and in the sitting room within seconds, because you started screaming and running pretty much instantaneously from what you said.
Another infinitesimal pause.
Yeah, she said. Well, I don't know. I think I screamed. I screamed while I was frozen on the spot, for a moment maybe. I was just so shocked. And Freddy came running out of the bedroom, and then I ran past him.
Did you stop to tell him what you'd seen?
I can't remember.
Bristow looked as though he was about to stage one of his untimely interventions again. Strike held up a hand to forestall him. But Tansy plunged off on another tack, eager, he guessed, to leave the subject of her husband.
I thought and thought about how the killer got in, and I'm sure he must have followed her inside when she came in that morning, because of Derek Wilson leaving his desk and being in the bathroom. I thought Wilson ought to have been bloody sacked for it, actually. If you ask me, he was having a sneaky sleep in the back room. I don't know how the killer would have known the key code, but I'm sure that's when he must have got in.
Do you think you'd be able to recognize the man's voice again? The one you heard shouting?
I doubt it, she said. It was just a man's voice. It could have been anyone. There was nothing unusual about it. I mean, afterwards I thought, was it Duffield? She said, gazing at him intently, because I'd heard Duffield shouting upstairs once before, from the top landing. Wilson had to throw him out. Duffield was trying to kick in Lula's door. I never understood what a girl with her looks was doing with someone like Duffield, she added in parenthesis.
Some women say sexy, agreed Ursula,
emptying the wine bottle into her glass.
But I can't see the appeal. He's just skanky and horrible.
It's not even, said Tansy, twisting the loose diamond ring again, as though he's got money.
But you don't think it was his voice you heard that night?
Well, like I say, it could have been, she said impatiently, with a small shrug of her thin shoulders. "He's got an alibi, though, hasn't he? Loads of people said he was nowhere near Kentigern Gardens the night Lula was killed. He spent part of it at Kiara Porter's, didn't he? Bitch," Tansy added, with a small, tight smile. "Sleeping with her best friend's boyfriend."
"Were they sleeping together?"
asked Strike.
"What do you think?"
laughed Ursula, as though the question was too naive for words.
"I know Kiara Porter. She modelled in this charity fashion show I was involved in setting up. She's such an airhead and such a slut."
The coffees had arrived, along with Strike's sticky toffee pudding. "I'm sorry, John, but Lula didn't have very good taste in friends," said Tansy, sipping her espresso. "There was Kiara, and then there was that Bryony Radford. Not that she was a friend, exactly, but I wouldn't trust her as far as I could throw her."
"Who's Bryony?" asked Strike disingenuously, for he remembered who she was.
"Makeup artist. Charges a fortune and such a bloody bitch," said Ursula. "I used her once, before one of the Gorbachev Foundation balls, and afterwards she told every—"
Ursula stopped abruptly, lowered her glass and picked up her coffee instead. Strike, who, despite its undoubted irrelevance to the matter in hand, was quite interested to know what Bryony had told everyone, began to speak. But Tansy talked loudly over him.
"Oh, and there was that ghastly girl Lula used to bring around to the flat too, John, remember?"
She appealed to Bristow again, but he looked blank.
"You know, that ghastly, that really awful coloured girl she sometimes dragged back. A kind of hobo person. I mean, she literally smelled. When she'd been in the lift, you could smell it. And she took her into the pool, too. I didn't think blacks could swim."
Bristow was blinking rapidly, pink in the face.
"God knows what Lula was doing with her," said Tansy. "Oh, you must remember, John. She was fat, scruffy, looked a bit subnormal."
"I don't," mumbled Bristow.
"Are you talking about Rochelle?" asked Strike.
"Oh, yeah, I think that was her name. She was at the funeral anyway," said Tansy. "I noticed her. She was sitting right at the back."
"Now, you will remember, won't you?" She turned the full force of her dark eyes upon Strike, "that this is all entirely off the record. I mean, I cannot afford for Freddy to find out I'm talking to you. I'm not going to go through all that shit with the press again. Bill, please," she barked at the waiter. When it arrived, she passed it without comment to Bristow. As the sisters were preparing to leave, shaking their glossy brown hair back over their shoulders and pulling on expensive jackets, the door of the restaurant opened and a tall, thin, besuited man of around 60 entered, looked around, and headed straight for their table. Silver-haired and distinguished-looking, impeccably dressed, there was a certain chilliness about his pale blue eyes. His walk was brisk and purposeful.
"This is a surprise," he said smoothly, stopping in the space between the two women's chairs.
None of the other three had seen the man coming, and all bar Strike displayed equal parts of shock and something more than displeasure at the sight of him. For a fraction of a second, Tansy and Ursula froze, Ursula in the act of pulling sunglasses out of her bag. Tansy recovered first.
"Cyprian," she said, offering her face for his kiss. "Yes, what a lovely surprise."
"I thought you were going shopping, Ursula dear," he said, his eyes on his wife as he gave Tansy a conventional peck on each cheek.
"We stop for lunch, Sips,"
she replied, but her colour was heightened and Strike sensed an ill-defined nastiness in the air. The older man's pale eyes moved deliberately over Strike and came to rest on Bristow.
"I thought Tony was handling your divorce, Tansy," he asked.
"He is," said Tansy. "This isn't a business lunch, Sips, purely social."
He gave a wintry smile.
"Let me escort you out then, my dears," he said.
With a cursory farewell to Bristow and no word whatsoever for Strike, the two sisters permitted themselves to be shepherded out of the restaurant by Ursula's husband.
When the door had swung shut behind the threesome, Strike asked Bristow,
"What was that about?"
"That was Cyprian," said Bristow. He seemed agitated as he fumbled with his credit card and the bill. "Cyprian May, Ursula's husband, senior partner at the firm. He won't like Tansy talking to you. I wonder how he knew where we were. Probably got it out of Alison."
"Why won't he like her talking to me?"
"Tansy's his sister-in-law," said Bristow, putting on his overcoat. "He won't want her to make a fool of herself, as he'll see it, all over again. I'll probably get a real bollocking for persuading her to meet you. I expect he's phoning my uncle right now to complain about me."
Bristow's hands, Strike noticed, were trembling. The lawyer left in a taxi ordered by the maitre d'. Strike headed away from Cipriani on foot, loosening his tie as he walked, and lost so deeply in thought that he was only jerked out of his reverie by a loud horn blast from a car he had not seen speeding towards him as he crossed Grosvenor Street. With this salutary reminder that his safety would otherwise be in jeopardy, Strike headed for a patch of pale wall belonging to the Elizabeth Arden Red Door Spa, leaned up against it out of the pedestrian flow, lit up, and pulled out his mobile phone. After some listening and fast-forwarding, he managed to locate that part of Tansy's recorded testimony that dealt with those moments immediately preceding Lula Landry's fall past her window.
"Towards the bedroom, I heard shouting. She, Lula, was saying, 'It's too late, I've already done it.' And then a man said, 'You're a lying fucking bitch.' And then he threw her over. I actually saw her fall."
He could just make out the tiny chink of Bristow's glass hitting the tabletop. Strike rewound again and listened.
"Saying, 'It's too late, I've already done it.' And then a man said, 'You're a lying fucking bitch.' And then he threw her over. I actually saw her fall."
He recalled Tansy's imitation of Landry's flailing arms and the horror on her frozen face as she did it. Slipping his mobile back into his pocket, he took out his notebook and began to make notes for himself. Strike had met countless liars. He could smell them. And he knew perfectly well that Tansy was of their number. She could not have heard what she claimed to have heard from her flat. The police had therefore deduced that she could not have heard it at all. Against Strike's expectation, however, in spite of the fact that every piece of evidence he had heard until this moment suggested that Lula Landry had committed suicide, he found himself convinced that Tansy Bestigui really believed that she had overheard an argument before Landry fell. That was the only part of her story that rang with authenticity, an authenticity that shone a garish light on the fakery with which she garnished it. Strike pushed himself off the wall and began to walk east along Grosvenor Street, paying slightly more attention to traffic, but inwardly recalling Tansy's expression, her tone, her mannerisms, as she spoke of Lula Landry's final moments. Why would she tell the truth on the essential point, but surround it with easily disproven falsehoods? Why would she lie about what she had been doing when she heard shouting from Landry's flat? Strike remembered Adler. A lie would have no sense unless the truth were felt as dangerous. Tansy had come along today to make a last attempt to find someone who would believe her, and yet swallow the lies in which she insisted on swaddling her evidence. He walked fast, barely conscious of the twinges from his right knee. At last he realized that he had walked all along Maddox Street and emerged on Regent Street. The red awnings of Hamley's toy shop fluttered a little in the distance, and Strike remembered that he had intended to buy a birthday present for his nephew's forthcoming birthday on the way back to the office. The multicoloured, squeaking, flashing maelstrom into which he walked registered on him only vaguely. Blindly he moved from floor to floor, untroubled by the shrieks, the whirring of airborne toy helicopters, the oinks of mechanical pigs moving across his distracted path. Finally, after 20 minutes or so, he came to rest near the HM Forces dolls. Here he stood, quite still, gazing at the ranks of miniature marines and paratroopers, but barely seeing them, deaf to the whispers of parents trying to manoeuvre their sons around him, too intimidated to ask the strange, huge, staring man to move. Part 3. Forsan et haec olim meminisse uvabit. Maybe one day it will be cheering even to remember these things. Virgil, Aeneid, Book 1. Chapter 1. It started to rain on Wednesday. London weather, dank and grey, through which the old city presented a stolid front. Pale faces under black umbrellas, the eternal smell of damp clothing, the steady pattering on Strike's office window in the night. The rain in Cornwall had a different quality when it came. Strike remembered how it had lashed like whips against the panes of Aunt Joan and Uncle Ted's spare room during those months in the neat little house that smelled of flowers and baking while he had attended the village school in St. Maur's. Such memories swam to the forefront of his mind whenever he was about to see Lucy. Raindrops were still dancing exuberantly on the windowsills on Friday afternoon, while at opposite ends of her desk, Robin wrapped Jack's new paratrooper doll, and Strike wrote her a check to the amount of a week's work, minus the commission of temporary solutions. Robin was about to attend the third of that week's proper interviews, and was looking neat and groomed in her black suit, with her bright gold hair pinned back in a chignon. "There you are," they both said simultaneously, as Robin pushed across the desk a perfect parcel patterned with small spaceships, and Strike held out the check.
"Cheers," said Strike, taking the present. "I can't rap."
"I hope he likes it," she replied, tucking the check away in her black handbag.
"Yeah, and good luck with the interview. Do you want the job?"
"Well, it's quite a good one. Human resources in a media consultancy in the West End," she said, sounding unenthusiastic. "Enjoy the party. I'll see you Monday." The self-imposed penance of walking down into Denmark Street to smoke became even more irksome in the ceaseless rain. Strike stood, minimally shielded beneath the overhang of his office entrance, and asked himself when he was going to kick the habit and set to work to restore the fitness that had slipped away, along with his solvency and his domestic comfort. His mobile rang while he stood there.
"Thought you might like to know your tip-off's paid dividends," said Eric Wardle, who sounded triumphant.
Strike could hear engine noise and the sound of men talking in the background.
"Quick work," commented Strike.
"Yeah, well, we don't hang around."
"Does this mean I'm going to get what I was after?"
"That's what I'm calling about. It's a bit late today, but I'll bike it over Monday."
"Sooner rather than later suits me. I can hang on here at the office."
Wardle laughed a little offensively.
"You get paid by the hour, don't you? I'd have thought it suited you to string it out a bit."
"Tonight would be better, if you can get it here this evening. I'll make sure you're the first to know if my old mate drops any more tip-offs."
In the slight pause that followed, Strike heard one of the men in the car with Wardle say,
"Fear in his fucking face."
"Yeah, all right," said Wardle. "I'll get it over later. Might not be till 7. Will you still be there?" "I'll make sure I am," Strike replied.
The file arrived 3 hours later, while he was eating fish and chips out of a small polystyrene tray in his lap and watching the London Evening News on his portable television. The courier buzzed the outer door, and Strike signed for a bulky package sent from Scotland Yard. Once unwrapped, a thick grey folder full of photocopied material was disclosed. Strike took it back to Robin's desk and began the lengthy process of digesting the contents. Here were statements from those who had seen Lula Landry during the final evening of her life. A report on the DNA evidence lifted from her flat. Photocopied pages of the visitor's book compiled by security at No. 18 Kentigern Gardens. Details of the medication Lula had been prescribed to control bipolar disorder. The autopsy report, medical records for the previous year, mobile phone and landline records, and a précis of the findings on the model's laptop. There was also a DVD on which Wardle had scribbled, CCTV, two runners. The DVD drive on Strike's second-hand computer had not worked since he acquired it. He therefore slipped the disc into the pocket of the overcoat hanging by the glass door and resumed his contemplation of the printed material contained within the ring binder, his notebook open beside him. Night descended outside the office, and a pool of golden light fell from the desk lamp onto each page as Strike methodically read the documents that had added up to a conclusion of suicide. Here, amid the statements shorn of superfluity, minutely detailed timings, the copied labels from the bottles of drugs found in Landry's bathroom cabinet, Strike tracked the truth he had sensed behind Tansy Bestigui's lies. The autopsy indicated that Lula had been killed on impact with the road, and that she had died from a broken neck and internal bleeding. There was a certain amount of bruising to the upper arms. She had fallen wearing only one shoe. The photographs of the corpse confirmed Lula my inspiration forever's assertion that Landry had changed her clothes on coming home from the nightclub. Instead of the dress in which she had been photographed entering her building, the corpse wore a sequin top and trousers. Strike turned to the shifting statements that Tansy had given to the police. The first simply claiming a trip to the bathroom from the bedroom, the second adding the opening of her sitting room window. Freddy, she said, had been in bed throughout. The police had found half a line of cocaine on the flat marble rim of the bath and a small plastic bag of the drug, hidden inside a box of Tampax, in the cabinet above the sink. Freddy's statement confirmed that he had been asleep when Landry fell and that he had been woken by his wife's screams. He said that he had hurried into the sitting room in time to see Tansy run past him in her underwear. The vase of roses he had sent to Mac, and which a clumsy policeman had smashed, were intended, he admitted, as a gesture of welcome and introduction. Yes, he would have been glad to strike up an acquaintance with the rapper, and yes, it had crossed his mind that Mac might be perfect in a thriller now in development. His shock at Landry's death had undoubtedly made him overreact to the ruin of his floral gift. He had initially believed his wife when she said she had overheard the argument upstairs. He had subsequently come, reluctantly, to accept the police view that Tansy's account was indicative of cocaine consumption. Her drug habit had placed great strain on the marriage, and he had admitted to the police that he was aware that his wife habitually used the stimulant, though he had not known that she had a supply in the flat that night. Bestigui further stated that he and Landry had never visited each other's flats, and that their simultaneous stay at Dickie Carberry's, which the police appear to have heard about on a subsequent occasion, for Freddy had been re-interviewed after the initial statement, had barely advanced their acquaintance. She associated mainly with the younger guests, while I spent most of the weekend with Dickie, who is a contemporary of mine. Bestigui's statement presented the unassailable front of a rock face without crampons. After reading the police account of events inside the Bestigui's flat, Strike added several sentences to his own notes. He was interested in the half a line of cocaine on the side of the bath, and even more interested in the few seconds after Tansy had seen the flailing figure of Lula Landry fall past the window. Much would depend, of course, on the layout of the Bestigui's apartment. There was no map or diagram of it in the folder. But Strike was bothered by one consistent aspect of Tansy's shifting stories. She insisted throughout that her husband had been in bed, asleep, when Landry fell. He remembered the way she had shielded her face by pretending to push back her hair as he pressed her on the point. All in all, and notwithstanding the police view, Strike considered the precise location of both Bestigui's at the moment Lula Landry fell off her balcony to be far from proven. He resumed his systematic perusal of the file. Evan Duffield's statement conformed in most respects to Wardle's second-hand tale. He admitted to having attempted to prevent his girlfriend leaving Uzi by seizing her by the upper arms. She had broken free and left. He had followed her shortly afterwards. There was a one-sentence mention of the wolf mask, couched in the unemotional language of the policeman who had interviewed him.
I am accustomed to wearing a wolf's head mask when I wish to avoid the attentions of photographers. A brief statement from the driver, who had taken Duffield from Uzi, confirmed Duffield's account of visiting Kentigern Gardens and moving on to Darbley Street, where he had dropped his passenger and left. The antipathy Wardle claimed the driver had felt towards Duffield was not conveyed in the bald, factual account prepared for his signature by the police. There were a couple of other statements supporting Duffield's. One from a woman who claimed to have seen him climbing the stairs to his dealer's, one from the dealer, Wycliffe himself. Strike recalled Wardle's expressed opinion that Wycliffe would lie for Duffield. The woman downstairs could have been cut in on any payment. The rest of the witnesses who claimed to have seen Duffield roaming the streets of London could only honestly say that they had seen a man in a wolf mask. Strike lit a cigarette and read through Duffield's statement again. He was a man with a violent temper who had admitted to attempting to force Lula to remain in the club. The bruising to the upper arms of the body was almost certainly his work. If, however, he had taken heroin with Wycliffe, Strike knew that the odds of him being in a fit state to infiltrate No. 18 Kentigern Gardens or to work himself into a murderous rage were negligible. Strike was familiar with the behaviour of heroin addicts. He had met plenty at the last squat his mother had lived in. The drug rendered its slaves passive and docile, the absolute antithesis of shouting violent alcoholics or twitchy paranoid coke users. Strike had known every kind of substance abuser, both inside the army and out. The glorification of Duffield's habit by the media disgusted him. There was no glamour in heroin. Strike's mother had died on a filthy mattress in the corner of the room, and nobody had realized she was dead for 6 hours. He got up, crossed the room, and wrenched open the dark, rain-spattered window, so that the thud of the bass from the 12-bar cafe became louder than ever. Still smoking, he looked out at Charing Cross Road, glittering with car lights and puddles, where Friday night revellers were striding and lurching past the end of Denmark Street, umbrellas wobbling, laughter ringing above the traffic. When, Strike wondered, would he next enjoy a pint on a Friday with friends? The notion seemed to belong to a different universe, a life left behind. The strange limbo in which he was living, with Robin his only real human contact, could not last, but he was still not ready to resume a proper social life. He had lost the army, and Charlotte, and half a leg. He felt a need to become thoroughly accustomed to the man he had become, before he felt ready to expose himself to other people's surprise and pity. The bright orange cigarette stub flew down into the dark street, and was extinguished in the watery gutter. Strike pushed down the window, returned to his desk, and pulled the file firmly back towards him. Derek Wilson's statement told him nothing he did not already know. There was no mention in the file of Kieran Colovis-Jones, or of his mysterious blue piece of paper. Strike turned next, with some interest, to the statements of the two women with whom Lula had spent her final afternoon, Kiara Porter and Bryony Radford. The makeup artist remembered Lula as cheerful and excited about D.B. Mack's imminent arrival. Porter, however, stated that Landry had not been herself, that she had seemed low and anxious, and had refused to discuss what was upsetting her. Porter's statement added an intriguing detail that nobody had yet told Strike. The model asserted that Landry had made specific mention that afternoon of an intention to leave everything to her brother. No context was given, but the impression left was of a girl in a clearly morbid frame of mind. Strike wondered why his client had not mentioned that his sister had declared her intention of leaving him everything. Of course, Bristow already had a trust fund. Perhaps the possible acquisition of further vast sums of money did not seem as noteworthy to him as it would to Strike, who had never inherited a penny. Yawning, Strike lit another cigarette to keep himself awake, and began to read the statement of Lula's mother. By Lady Yvette Bristow's own account, she had been drowsy and unwell in the aftermath of her operation. But she insisted that her daughter had been perfectly happy when she came to visit that morning, and had evinced nothing but concern for her mother's condition and prospects of recovery. Perhaps the blunt, unnuanced prose of the recording officer was to blame, but Strike took from Lady Bristow's recollections the impression of a determined denial. She alone suggested that Lula's death had been an accident, that she had somehow slipped over the balcony without meaning to. It had been, said Lady Bristow, an icy night. Strike skim-read Bristow's statement, which tallied in all respects with the account he had given Strike in person, and proceeded to that of Tony Landry, John and Lula's uncle. He had visited Yvette Bristow at the same time as Lula on the day before the latter's death, and asserted that his niece had seemed normal. Landry had then driven to Oxford, where he had attended a conference on international developments in family law, staying overnight in the Malmaison Hotel. His account of his whereabouts was followed by some incomprehensible comments about telephone calls. Strike turned, for elucidation, to the annotated copies of phone records. Lula had barely used her landline in the week prior to her death, and not at all on the day before she died. From her mobile, however, she had made no fewer than 66 calls on her last day of life. The first, at 9:15 in the morning, had been to Evan Duffield. The second, at 9:35, to Kiara Porter. There followed a gap of hours in which she had spoken to nobody on the mobile, and then, at 1:21, she had begun a positive frenzy of telephoning two numbers, almost alternately. One of these was Duffield's, the other belonged, according to the crabbed scribble beside the number's first appearance, to Tony Landry. Again and again she had telephoned these two men. Here and there were gaps of 20 minutes or so, during which she made no calls. Then she would begin telephoning again, doubtless hitting redial. All of this frenetic calling, Strike deduced, must have taken place once she was back in her flat with Bryony Radford and Kiara Porter, though neither of the two women's statements made mention of repeated telephoning. Strike turned back to Tony Landry's statement, which cast no light on the reason his niece had been so anxious to contact him. He had turned off the sound on his mobile while at the conference, he said, and had not realised until much later that his niece had called him repeatedly that afternoon. He had no idea why she had done so, and had not called her back, giving as his reason that by the time he realised that she'd been trying to reach him, she had stopped calling, and he had guessed, correctly as it turned out, that she would be in a nightclub somewhere. Strike was now yawning every few minutes. He considered making himself coffee, but could not muster the energy. Wanting his bed, but driven on by habit to complete the job in hand, he turned to the copies of security logbook pages showing the entrances and exits of visitors to number 18 on the day preceding Lula Landry's death. A careful perusal of signatures and initials revealed that Wilson had not been as meticulous in his record-keeping as his employers might have hoped. As Wilson had already told Strike, the movements of the building's residents were not recorded in the book, so the comings and goings of Landry and the Bestiguis were missing. The first entry Wilson had made was for the postman, at 9:10. Next, at 9:22, came florist delivery, flat 2. Finally, at 9:50, security bell. No time of departure was marked for the alarm checker. Otherwise it had been, as Wilson had said, a quiet day. Kiara Porter had arrived at 12:50, Bryony Radford at 1:20. While Radford's departure was recorded with her own signature at 4:40, Wilson had added the entrance of caterers to the Bestiguis flat at 7, Kiara's exit with Lula at 7:15, and the departure of the caterers at 9:15. It frustrated Strike that the only page that the police had photocopied was the day before Landry's death, because he had hoped that he might find the surname of the elusive Rochelle somewhere in the entrance logs pages. It was nearly midnight when Strike turned his attention to the police report on the contents of Landry's laptop. They appeared to have been searching, principally, for emails indicating suicidal mood or intent, and in this respect, they had been unsuccessful. Strike scanned the emails Landry had sent and received in the last 2 weeks of her life. It was strange, but nevertheless true, that the countless photographs of her otherworldly beauty and made it harder rather than easier for Strike to believe that Landry had ever really existed. The ubiquity of her features had made them seem abstract, generic, even if the face itself had been uniquely beautiful. Now, however, out of these dry black marks on paper, out of erratically spelled messages littered with in-jokes and nicknames, the wraith of the dead girl rose before him in the dark office. Her emails gave him what the multitude of photographs had not. A realization in the gut, rather than the brain, that a real, living, laughing and crying human being had been smashed to death on that snowy London street. He had hoped to spot the flickering shadow of a murderer as he turned the file's pages, but instead it was the ghost of Lula herself who emerged, gazing up at him, as victims of violent crime sometimes did, through the detritus of their interrupted lives. He saw now why John Bristow insisted that his sister had had no thought of death. The girl who had typed out these words emerged as a warm-hearted friend, sociable, impulsive, busy, and glad to be so, enthusiastic about her job, excited, as Bristow had said, about the prospect of a trip to Morocco. Most of the emails had been sent to the designer, Guy Sommet. They held nothing of interest except a tone of cheery confidentiality, and once a mention of her most incongruous friendship. "Gigi, will you please make Rochelle something for her birthday? Please, please. I'll pay. Something nice, don't be horrible. For Feb 21st, pleasey please, love ya, cuckoo." Strike remembered the assertion of Lula, my inspiration forever, that Lula had loved Guy Sommet like a brother. His statement to the police was the shortest in the file. He had been in Japan for a week and had arrived home on the night of her death. Strike knew that Sommet lived within easy walking distance of Kentigern Gardens, but the police appear to have been satisfied with his assertion that, once home, he had simply gone to bed. Strike had already noted the fact that anyone walking from Charles Street would have approached Kentigern Gardens from the opposite direction to the CCTV camera on Alderbrook Road. Strike closed the file at last. As he moved laboriously through his office, undressing, removing the prosthesis and unfolding the camp bed, he thought of nothing but his own exhaustion. He fell asleep quickly, lulled by the sounds of humming traffic, the pattering rain, and the deathless breath of the city. Chapter 2. A large magnolia tree stood in the front garden of Lucy's house in Bromley. Later in the spring, it would cover the front lawn in what looked like crumpled tissues. Now, in April, it was a frothy cloud of white, its petals waxy as coconut shavings. Strike had only visited this house a few times, because he preferred to meet Lucy away from her home, where she always seemed most harried, and to avoid encounters with his brother-in-law, for whom his feelings were on the cooler side of tepid. Helium-filled balloons tied to the gate bobbled in the light breeze. As Strike walked down the steeply sloping front path to the door, the package Robin had wrapped under his arm, he told himself that it would soon be over. "Where's Charlotte?" demanded Lucy, short, blonde and round-faced, immediately upon opening the front door. More big golden foil balloons, this time in the shape of the number 7, filled the hall behind her. Screams that might have denoted excitement or pain were issuing from some unseen region of the house, disturbing the suburban peace.
"She had to go back to Ayr for the weekend," lied Strike.
"Why?"
asked Lucy, standing back to let him in. "Another crisis with her sister. Where's Jack?"
"They're all through here.
Thank God it stopped raining, or we'd have had to have them in the house," said Lucy, leading him out into the back garden.
They found his three nephews tearing around the large back lawn with 20 assorted boys and girls in party clothes, who were shrieking their way through some game that involved running to various cricket stumps on which pictures of pieces of fruit had been taped. Parent helpers stood around in the weak sunlight, drinking wine out of plastic cups, while Lucy's husband, Greg, manned an iPod standing in a dock on a trestle table. Lucy handed Stryker lager, then dashed away from him almost immediately to pick up the youngest of her three sons, who had fallen hard and was bawling with gusto. Stryker had never wanted children. It was one of the things on which he and Charlotte had always agreed, and it had been one of the reasons other relationships over the years had foundered. Lucy deplored his attitude, and the reasons he gave for it. She was always miffed when he stated life aims that differed from hers, as though he were attacking her decisions and choices.
"All right there, Corm,"
said Greg, who had handed over the control of the music to another father. Strike's brother-in-law was a quantity surveyor, who never seemed quite sure what tone to take with Stryker, and usually settled for a combination of chippiness and aggression that Stryker found irksome.
"Where's that gorgeous Charlotte? Not split up again, have you? Ha ha ha! I can't keep track!"
One of the little girls had been pushed over. Greg hurried off to help one of the other mothers deal with more tears and grass stains. The game roared on in chaos. At last, a winner was declared. There were more tears from the runner-up, who had to be placated with a consolation prize from the black bin bag sitting beside the hydrangeas. A second round of the same game was then announced.
"Hi there," said a middle-aged matron, sidling up to Stryker. "You must be Lucy's brother."
"Yeah," he said.
"We heard all about your poor leg," she said, staring down at his shoes. "Lucy kept us all posted. Gosh, you wouldn't even know, would you? I couldn't even see you limping when you arrived. Isn't it amazing what they can do these days? I expect you can run faster now than you could before."
Perhaps she imagined that he had a single carbon fibre prosthetic blade under his trousers, like a Paralympian. He sipped his lager and forced a humourless smile.
"Is it true?" she asked, ogling him, her face suddenly full of naked curiosity. "Are you really Johnny Rokeby's son?"
Some thread of patience, which Stryker could not realise was strained to breaking point, snapped.
"Fucked if I know," he said. "Why don't you call him and ask?"
She looked stunned. After a few seconds, she walked away from him in silence. He saw her talking to another woman who glanced towards Stryker. Another child fell over, crashing its head onto the cricket stump, decorated with a giant strawberry, and emitting an ear-splitting shriek. With all attention focused on the fresh casualty, Stryker slipped back inside the house. The front room was blandly comfortable, with a beige three-piece suite, an impressionist print over the mantelpiece, and framed photographs of his three nephews in their bottle-green school uniform displayed on shelves. Stryker closed the door carefully on the noise from the garden, took from his pocket the DVD Wardle had sent, inserted it into the player, and turned on the TV. There was a photograph on top of the set, taken at Lucy's 30th birthday party. Lucy's father, Rick, was there with his second wife. Stryker stood at the back, where he had been placed in every group photograph since he was 5 years old. He had been in possession of two legs then. Tracy, fellow SIB officer and the girl whom Lucy had hoped her brother would marry, was standing next to him. Tracy had subsequently married one of their mutual friends and had recently given birth to a daughter. Stryker had meant to send flowers, but had never got round to it. He dropped his gaze to the screen and pressed play. The grainy black-and-white footage began immediately. A white street, thick blobs of snow drifting past the eye of the camera. The 180-degree view showed the intersection of Bellamy and Alderbrook Roads. A man walked, alone, into view, from the right side of the screen. Tall, his hands deep in his pockets, swathed in layers, a hood over his head. His face looked strange in the black-and-white footage. It tricked the eye. Stryker thought that he was looking at a stark white lower face and a dark blindfold, before reason told him that he was, in fact, looking at a dark upper face, and a white scarf tied over the nose, mouth and chin. There was some kind of mark, perhaps a blurry logo, on his jacket. Otherwise, his clothing was unidentifiable.
As the walker approached the camera, he bowed his head and appeared to consult something he drew out of his pocket. Seconds later, he turned up Bellamy Road and disappeared out of range of the camera. The digital clock in the lower right-hand portion of the screen registered 01:39. The film jumped. Here again was the blurred view of the same intersection, apparently deserted, the same heavy flakes of snow obscuring the view, but now the clock in the lower corner read 02:12. The two runners burst into view. The one in front was recognisable as the man who had walked out of range with his white scarf over his mouth. Long-legged and powerful, he ran, his arms pumping, straight back down Alderbrook Road. The second man was smaller, slighter, hooded and hatted. Strike noticed the dark fists, clenched as he pelted along behind the first, losing ground to the taller man all the way. Under a street lamp, a design on the back of his sweatshirt was briefly illuminated. Halfway along Alderbrook Road, he veered suddenly left and up a side street. Strike replayed the few seconds' footage again, and then again. He saw no sign of communication between the two runners, no sign that they had called to each other, or even looked for each other, as they sprinted away from the camera. It seemed to have been every man for himself. He replayed the footage for a fourth time, and froze it, after several attempts, at the second when the design on the back of the slower man's sweatshirt had been illuminated. Squinting at the screen, he edged closer to the blurry picture. After a minute's prolonged staring, he was almost sure that the first word ended in CK, but the second, which he thought began with a J, was indecipherable. He pressed play and let the film run on, trying to make out which street the second man had taken. Three times Strike watched him split away from his companion, and although its name was unreadable on screen, he knew, from what Wardle had said, that it must be Halliwell Street. The police had thought that the fact that the first man had picked up a friend off-camera diminished his plausibility as a killer. This was assuming that the two were, indeed, friends. Strike had to concede that the fact that they had been caught on film together, in such weather, and at such an hour, acting in an almost identical fashion, suggested complicity. Allowing the footage to run on, he watched as it cut, in almost startling fashion, to the interior of a bus. A girl got on, filmed from a position above the driver. Her face was foreshortened and heavily shadowed, though her blonde ponytail was distinctive. The man who followed her onto the bus bore, as far as it was possible to see, a strong resemblance to the one who had later walked up Bellamy Street towards Kentigan Gardens. He was tall and hooded, with a white scarf over his face, the upper part lost in shadow. All that was clear was the logo on his chest, a stylized GS. The film jerked to show Theobald's Road. If the individual walking fast along it was the same person who had got on the bus, he had removed his white scarf, although his build and walk were strongly reminiscent. This time, Strike thought that the man was making a conscious effort to keep his head bowed. The film ended in a blank black screen. Strike sat looking at it, deep in thought. When he recalled himself to his surroundings, it was a slight surprise to find them multicoloured and sunlit. He took his mobile out of his pocket and called John Bristow, but reached only voicemail. He left a message telling Bristow that he had now viewed the CCTV footage and read the police file, that there were a few more things he would like to ask, and would it be possible to meet Bristow sometime during the following week. He then called Derek Wilson, whose telephone likewise went to voicemail, to which he reiterated his request to come and view the interior of 18 Kentigern Gardens. Strike had just hung up when the sitting room door opened and his middle nephew, Jack, sidled in. He looked flushed and overwrought.
"I heard you talking," Jack said.
He closed the door just as carefully as his uncle had done.
"Aren't you supposed to be in the garden, Jack?"
"I've been for pay," said his nephew. "Uncle Cormoran, did you bring me a present?"
Strike,
who had not relinquished the wrapped parcel since arriving, handed it over and watched as Robin's careful handiwork was destroyed by small, eager fingers.
"Cool," said Jack